Hey there, Rick Singeri of Vermont Edition. Just want you to know this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. I know journalists are supposed to be neutral on all things, but I will let you in on a little secret. I love wild animals, all wild animals. Well, actually, I'm not that keen on possums or deer flies. But otherwise, just give me an animal show to do, and I'm not even going to pretend to hide my enthusiasm. Luckily, my enthusiasm is matched today, if not exceeded, by our guest, Jim Andrews, coordinator of the Vermont Reptile and Amphibian Atlas. And in terms of knowledge, boy, I mean, you just can't compare to Jim. He's amazing. So today we're going to celebrate, explore, and get a better understanding of the herptiles around us. Jim, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
It's great to be here.
Is there such a thing as herp news, breaking news headlines in the herpetology world?
Well, of course there are.
Can you give us a few headlines?
Well, you know about some of them. You know that there's a new study going on. You know that there's some diseases in salamanders that we're particularly concerned about that we've got to be on the lookout for. We're getting a variety of odd reports from imported species that have apparently traveled in boats and cars and mulch and plants. Most of those species won't survive, though, with our winters. Our winters are just too cold for those guys, which is good for us, too bad for them.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good thing, right? We don't want these non-native species coming in.
We do not want those non-natives. I mean, there's a whole book, and people probably know about or have heard about the Burmese pythons in Florida. There's a whole book of invasive and imported reptiles and amphibians in the Everglades. I mean, there's many, many species that have been able to survive here. And there are species that get released here.
I think even a python was captured by Fish and Wildlife last year, right?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. But they won't survive our winters, or at least the winters that we've had in the past. So it's good for us.
Are there reptiles or amphibians that are getting released in Vermont that are non-native, that you know are being kept as pets, that then can make it and could cause a problem?
Well, the only one that seems to survive is the red-eared slider, and that's a fairly common, or probably the most common, aquarium turtle.
Glad you said turtle, because, you know, slider,
yeah,
skink,
slider?
Racers.
Yeah, we've got a lot
to talk about.
Right. And that particular species does seem to survive, and actually it's become invasive and taken over some habitat in Massachusetts and Connecticut, so just barely south of us. But here in Vermont, it seems to survive, but it has not bred. I think that its breeding cycle and egg-laying cycle is too much out of sync with our winter and spring, so that it really tries to lay eggs too soon, too early, and it won't work.
Again, probably better for our creatures.
Yeah. A good thing, yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the conservation projects that have been going on. And Jim, I know you've been keen to talk for a while now about the amphibian underpass in Moncton, my town, which I pass over frequently, and a completely unobtrusive underpass for humans, but helpful for these small crossing animals.
Absolutely. Have you seen the spotted salamander that's on the side of the road there?
Yes, there is a very large, not real, spotted salamander.
Yeah, I've had people call me up and say, how large are these spotted salamanders? I saw a spotted salamander in Moncton. It must have been 3 feet long.
Yeah, it's the size of a dog. It's not real, but it's a happy joke on the Moncton Front Porch Forum.
Yeah, it was anonymously placed. Somebody carved it out of wood, did a beautiful job painting it, and put it in front of one of the underpasses. And so now it has the company of many living but much smaller spotted salamanders. Yeah, well, that was just a neat project. And as a matter of fact, that project just got an award from the Federal Highways Administration. So the town of Moncton and the partners that were involved in that for excellence in conservation, which is really neat.
Well, and for people who are unaware of it, there are actually two little underpasses that were built under the road in a place where it's a specific problem for reptiles and amphibians during the migratory season. So a lot of salamanders and little frogs and toads were getting killed on the road on rainy spring nights, and there were volunteers who would help carry them across in buckets. But the idea was, if we can build an underpass, we can actually just let them go on their own, be safer for humans, be much safer for the salamanders and frogs. But the question, I guess, had always been, you know, from an outside perspective, is this really effective? You have these two little underpasses. Are the animals really going to use them? And it looks like they have been.
It has been really effective. We're monitoring that particular spot in two ways. And one way was to put cameras in the tunnels, and amphibians would not trigger most wildlife cameras because there's no temperature difference between their body and the background. And that's really what, for mammals and birds, that's what triggers cameras. But so we set these cameras up so that they took pictures every minute, every night in the spring. And we were able to count. And, you know, I spent a lot of time downloading thousands of pictures and looking through those pictures. But over 2,200 amphibians crossed through this tunnel. There's two tunnels. They cross through the tunnel in either one direction or the other. So we know that it's an effective tunnel. There's lots of amphibians using it that are getting across the road safely. Now, there's another study still going on that will give us a feel for what percentage of the amphibians are actually going through the tunnel as opposed to still trying to go over the road. And that'll be a couple of years before we get that data. But there's no question that it's been a very, very effective tunnel system. And it's getting lots of attention. We've had other states ask us for ideas and in terms of how to design tunnels in their place and to see our designs. But I probably should step back a little bit, Jane, just to give you some background there. Clearly, there's wildlife being killed on roads all over the state. And we just can't – you can't afford to put tunnels everywhere that it would be nice to have them. So you have to come up with some way to prioritize crossing areas. And the way I've done that with reptiles and amphibians is to try to find places that have either huge numbers, huge diversity, different types of species, or some rarities. And this particular site had all three. And then lastly, I've got a site like that. Let's say but in the town of Salisbury where I live, there's a site that has the numbers and the rarity, et cetera, but it doesn't have any traffic.
Right.
And so there's very little mortality. But at this Moncton site, it has become a very, very heavily used road. I mean, it's only a two-lane paved town road, but it still gets heavy traffic. And so we had high mortality. And so it was a logical place to try to put the first tunnels. Now, of course, we had a tremendous advantage in that on the Moncton Conservation Commission, we had a fish and wildlife non-game biologist, and we also had an environmental person from VTrans, Chris Flesar and Steve Perrin. And so with their help and the Lewis Creek Association and lots of donors, private
Right. This
donors,
was done without taxpayer money, right?
Well, there was an FHA grant, Federal Highways Administration, and what the Transportation Enhancement Grant. Those things are for flower medians, bike paths, that kind of stuff. They're not for bridges and that kind of stuff, transportation enhancement. So in that sense, yeah, there was some taxpayer dollars, and there's some federal dollars that came through U.S. Fish and Wildlife. So there were some, but there was a huge amount of money that was raised through private donations and an online Indiegogo campaign, and we had money coming in from India and all kinds of places. And some donors gave as much as, say, $5,000. Woody Jackson made paintings, and he was giving paintings to donors or prints of the paintings to donors. So lots of people were helping out with that project. And we're just really excited that – well, you know, after all these people making this kind of commitment, when I'm there looking at these pictures that are coming from the tunnel, and I'm hoping there better be some amphibians coming through these tunnels. And pretty soon there's 1, 2, 5, 15 in one shot. And we made a little video of it that we've put on our website, our Facebook page, Vermont Reptile Amphibian Atlas, and people are welcome to see it.
It's pretty
neat. It's a very impressive and effective outreach tool. But we learned from other people who had tried tunnels in around us. This was not the first amphibian tunnel, and I should broaden that a little bit because it hasn't been just amphibians. It's been bobcats and porcupines really seem to like it, and a variety of skunks and other mammals have used this underpass as well. But we learned from a nice underpass in the Albany area. There's one of the oldest is in Massachusetts. There's one in a couple in New Hampshire. There's one north of us in the northeastern township. So we learned from previous efforts, and I think we moved the ball ahead a little bit. So it's really neat to see this working.
Let's go to a few calls and listeners who have questions for you. Montana is calling in from Duxbury. Hi, Montana. Go ahead.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hello.
Thank you for taking my call. I live on the river road that goes from Waterbury Steel Bridge along the river to Camel's Hump Road on the Waterbury side, and approximately 2.5 miles from just crossing that bridge after turning right, there is an area that's a migration corridor that looks like one because I've been watching this road and picking up animals for a long time. Last winter and spring, that whole road was graded so severely from that whole 4/10 of a mile that those animals had no way of crossing at all. So it's a mess. This year, I only see a couple a day crossing, even when the road's kind of damp, of the red Fs. And is there anything I can do?
Well, I would think that the grading shouldn't have an impact on the amphibians' ability to cross. I mean, the amphibians are coming from the woods on one side and trying to get to a wetland on the other side. So the road itself is not important habitat. It's a barrier, but ordinarily amphibians can get across. I'm wondering if maybe the decline in numbers had something to do with weather, overwintering conditions, other factors. I bet you will see amphibians there again next spring when we get the right conditions. The first warm, rainy nights with temperatures above freezing. They should be. Yeah, amphibians are pretty good at getting over most barriers. And, well, the barriers that we created are 2-foot-high vertical barriers of cement. But otherwise, I think they should still be able to get across that road pretty well.
So Montana's asking about red efts, these eastern salamanders. And if you're in certain places, they are very, very common. I went for a trail run the other day and thought, well, I'm just going to count how many I see. And I think I got up to 74. Mm-hmm. And that was just, not even trying very hard. But then there must be other places around the state where you really, it's a really rare thing to see these because they're so, I just love them. They're one of my all-time favorite animals. But some people aren't as lucky as I am to see 74 in one little span.
Right. Well, let's first talk about the weather conditions, Jane, that you were
it was
out.
Post-rain, yeah. Nice and damp, yeah. Still gray skies.
Yeah.
Yes.
The red Fs are one of the few salamanders that you'll see wandering around during the day because they have a fairly high toxin load, and they're advertising that with their bright orange color and their red spots. By toxin load, you can handle them. Just don't eat them. Okay.
I have not tried that.
As soon as the leaf litter dries out, if you're running in that same section or walking in that same section, and if we could go in Vermont, if we could go this year, 2 weeks without rain, things would dry out and these guys would have to hide to maintain their body moisture.
Right.
If they dry out, they die. So first of all, you were somewhere near a pond or a beaver pond or a river or some place, and you also had moist soils. But there are places in Vermont, like you're saying, where we're just not getting reports of even a relatively common species like the red eft. And by the way, the red eft is the terrestrial stage, the bright red stage of the eastern newt. But were you to go north and east and get out of all these nice hardwoods that we have and all this nice leaf litter that we have and into more acidic soils – and pines and red spruce and firs, then it can become more and more difficult to find newts. I mean, there are many towns in the Northeast Kingdom, Essex County, Caledonia, Orleans, where we have no reports of eastern newts. And I think that's just a habitat-related thing. If you were to find somebody's maple sugar orchard up there with some water body next to it and walk around in that maple sugar orchard on a wet day, then we could get some reports. But they're just not as widespread in those more acidic and northeastern locations as they are for those of us who live in the oaks and hickories and maples and
But that's fine, right? I mean, that's okay.
Oh, yeah, that's okay. But in terms of one of my goals is to find out the species that are present in each of the towns in Vermont and then make that information available to those towns. And I suspect that there are pockets of eastern newts in some of those towns that we're just unaware of. And so don't take them for granted. If you're from one of those Northeast Kingdom towns and you can snap a photo of an eastern newt and send it into the Vermont Herp Atlas or directly to me at my email, then I would love to see it. And there's also a couple places, islands, like Isle LaMotte. We have not yet received a report of a red F from Isle LaMotte. And in some cases, we don't get those reports because there's very few people living in a given town. It's pretty remote. I mean, Warner's Grant has nobody in it and it has no roads. So unless we go there, we're not going to get a lot of reports. But there's certainly people out on Isle LaMotte. And if somebody was to see either a stream salamander, which would be hard because what streams are out there, you know, or eastern newt, boy, that would be an interesting report.
And Jim, you are looking for reports. I mean, this is a citizen science project,
Absolutely.
The Vermont Reptile and Amphibian Atlas, and we have a link at vpr.net, and it also has a Facebook page. But you're looking for reports, sightings, photographs, and then you map out where all of the sightings are and you map where photographs have come from. So you're looking for all of the reptile and amphibian species in Vermont and reports from anybody who is willing to share.
Absolutely. And if you visit our website, you can look up your town or you can look up an individual species and see if it's been reported before. And maybe it's been reported, but nobody photographed it. Ideally, we're looking for photographs, photo documentation. This is kind of a replacement for what used to be a specimen that would end up in a museum. But in our case, it's just a photograph, and so it just goes electronically into a file. And then years to come, somebody can check and say, okay, yeah, there were – such and such a species and such a town. And we have pretty good coverage for many, many common species. But let me throw one out, if I might. Common garter snake. This is the snake. This is like 19 out of any 20 snakes that anybody has ever seen in this state in the Northeast, because it's a rugged snake and it's a generalist and it survives well and in our cold climate. And we have common garter snake records from every single town in this state except, okay, somebody out there. Is somebody out there from Belvedere? And do you have a common garter snake in your yard that you could send us a picture of? Because, boy, I would love to fill in that one. It's like having a jigsaw puzzle, and you've got all of the pieces in, but there's a piece missing, one single piece. And Belvedere is the missing piece for garter snakes in Vermont.
I hope you have people just running outside right now in Belvedere spreading out to take photos. We've had people sending us photos, a lot of photos of red efts, as I mentioned. Todd says, I've noticed quite a few newts in my yard in the village of Bristol, and sends us a photo. Beck says, while hiking at Niquette Bay State Park this past weekend, I saw many critters along the trail, including red efts, like the cute little guy I snapped a picture of below. If it was autumn, I would have mistaken them for fallen maple leaves. Dennis in Granville, New York says, when hiking, I often see red efts standing in the open on the trail and worry about them being stepped on. But I've started to wonder if this is a protective behavior because they want to make the most of their warning coloration. Might not be as protective if they were half hidden in leaves. And Jim, you said that red efts don't worry quite as much as maybe some other species because they do have this get away from me warning color.
Yeah, and of course that works well with most predators that have made the mistake of trying to eat a red eft once. But it doesn't work so well with cars, ATVs.
Even mountain bikes.
Mountain bikes, even human feet. Or a bear's foot. And the first reaction for many herps when they see a predator is to freeze, because movement attracts the attention of a predator. And so you've probably seen that at your bird feeder when a hawk comes by, and all of a sudden you look out at your bird feeder and you see that none of the chickadees are all frozen in place and none of them have moved. And you start looking around and you realize that there's probably a Cooper's hawk in a tree somewhere. And so the amphibians do the same thing. And unfortunately, in a road or on a trail, it doesn't work so well for them. So we frequently move them. I mean, if the red eft is right in the middle of the trail, we just pick them up and put them off to the side. And of course, that can make for a pretty slow walk at some times.
Really.
You know, you're moving lots and lots of those critters. Somebody mentioned Niket Bay, and Niket Bay is really a pretty interesting spot. It's that bay itself is one of the few places where we get reports of a different turtle, the eastern musk turtle, which is just a tiny little turtle, maybe 3 or 4 inches long, and it lives in that bay, which is kind of an extension of Mallet's Bay, and it nests on those beaches, and it's really pretty interesting. They've also seen a four-toed salamander there, which most of the listening audience probably has no idea what a four-toed salamander is, but you probably have seen redback salamanders underneath a tarp in your garden or your wood pile or a piece of bark, just a skinny little 3-inch dark reddish salamander with dark sides. But there's another one that's about the same size, and if you were to flip it over, it would be bright white with scattered black spots.
Cool.
And it's easy to recognize if you flip it over. And it is easy to flip over compared to a redback salamander. You try to flip a redback salamander over, and it will fight you all the way, and it's very active. This species is quite a bit more docile.
And it has four toes?
It actually does have four toes on the hind feet. Whereas most amphibians have 4 in the front and 5 on the back. But actually counting the toes of a little tiny salamander like that is just not an easy thing. It's not an easy thing to do. And it's easier just to flip them over and look for that bright white underside. But I'll take this opportunity, if I could, to mention that somebody reported, and this came in through iNaturalist, which is an online reporting system for wildlife. Somebody reported a four-toed salamander from Bennington County, and it's the first record ever documented from Bennington County. But all I have on that is kind of a iNaturalist handle rather than anybody's name. And so I can't find out who that was, nor exactly where that was. And if you're the person...
Do you remember what the handle is?
No, I don't. I should have written that down. If you're the person from Bennington County who sent a picture to the Vermont Atlas of Life of a four-toed salamander, please do get in touch with me. I'd love to know where that was. And it would be the first documented, well-documented record from Bennington County.
Very cool. Well, if you're listening right now, you can call and talk to Jim right this minute, 800-639-2211. Again, 1-800-639-2211. But we do have a link up to the Vermont Reptile and Amphibian Atlas on our page, the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net, so you can get in touch with Jim that way as well. Let's go to Nan calling in from West Windsor. Hi, Nan. Go ahead.
Hi there.
Hi.
Last spring, I saw what I thought was a little gray stone on my lawn, so I went to pick it up and it hopped. I looked at it, it's a little toad or frog of some sort. So I looked on the internet and it described gray tree frogs as some of what we call spring peepers. So I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about this cute little critter.
Okay, well, you mentioned two creatures there, two different creatures, one species being the spring peeper, which is super widespread in the state, every town, and makes that high-pitched beep, beep, beep in the spring. But this other dude that you're talking about that I think is probably the one you saw, the gray tree frog, is really a neat creature, one of my favorite frogs. And it's bumpy, so some people refer to it as a tree toad. You know, it has kind of a grayish background with bumps on it. But it's also Latin name Hyla versicolor, and versicolor meaning that it can actually change its color depending on its background. And other species can change from maybe light green to dark green or light brown to dark brown. But this one can go from white to green to gray, and it's really impressive. But it has also what are called flash colors underneath the hind legs and around the waist. Flash colors being bright yellow, and those flash colors are advertising the same way that the red F that we were talking about earlier was, that it does have a higher toxin load, but it doesn't want to show off those yellow colors unless it has to. And so
– so then it gives you a high kick if you come too close?
Pretty much. One of my young students did some experiments with snakes, and when a garter snake or a water snake got close to them, they would stand up essentially and expose the inner sides of their back legs, that bright yellow. And so that was a warning, okay, this is who I am. But if they don't do that, they have what's called a lichenate pattern, which is just a great camouflage pattern that looks like the lichen on a tree or a rock. And ordinarily, I think if this frog was not in your yard, if it was against a tree or on a rock, you would have had a really hard time seeing it unless you accidentally just leaned against it and it moved. They do have a high enough toxin level so that when injured, and I've moved a couple out of the road when they're injured, they're really pumping out the toxins. It's a defensive mechanism. So, you know, it's like a predator has taken them. And so there's more toxin on the skin than it would be when they weren't hurt. And so I've gotten that on my hands and then rub my eyes, and my eyes will burn and run for maybe 40, 45 minutes. And you would think a reasonably intelligent person would not have done that more than once. But I have done that more
than
once.
Think of it as experimentation.
Yeah, you want to get a good sample size. But it's a neat frog, and you may have heard the – let me try this. In May and June on really warm nights, and sometimes just a human day, and that's the call of the gray tree frog.
Huh. Very cool. While you're talking IDs of frogs, we got a note from Robert who says, who is this little guy with the black mask? And he has a picture of, I assume it's his hand, and a tiny little frog on it that is smaller than a thumbnail. I mean, this frog is the cutest thing you've ever seen.
Yeah, this is this year's crop of wood frogs. Wood frogs are one of the first to lay their eggs in the spring, and they got to do that because they're laying their eggs in vernal pools that might dry up or often dry up. So they got to get to those ponds early, lay their eggs, and then they go through the tadpole. The eggs hatch, the larvae go through the tadpole stage, and then right about now they're leaving. They're metamorphosing, losing the tail, resorbing the tail, actually recycling the tail into other body parts, coming out on land. And when they first come on land, they could easily sit on your thumbnail. They are tiny. If they have a pond that lasts a little bit longer, they can stay in the water and emerge at a slightly larger size, which gives them an advantage. There are fewer things that can eat them. But on the other hand, if the pond dries up fairly quickly, they will emerge sooner and smaller. But the picture that you send shows kind of an average-sized recently metamorphosed wood frog. And once you notice them and then you get down there on your hands and knees and you start looking around, you realize, geez, there's quite a few of them down here hopping around like cricket-sized critters.
Yeah. Oh, cute.
And, of course, it's the bottom of the food chain for everything from hermit thrushes to short-tailed shrews.
We also have a note from David who says, I normally wouldn't bother Mr. Andrews with a picture of a garter snake. I'm assuming that David does not live in Belvedere, so we don't have to worry.
Yeah.
But we don't know. But David says, but this one in Bennington from last week came in at 37 inches. I'm wondering what the state record for a garter snake is. And he actually measured it. So we have his record of 37 inches.
Yeah, David, that's pretty huge. I mean, when you get a garter snake, any garter snake over 36...
Jim's looking it up.
Then that's big. That's big. But let me just see. Snakes. Common garter snake. I have this. It's on the website. Relative lengths. Record length for common garter is 41. Sorry. A little bit bigger.
So no record for David, but 37 is pretty long for
pretty
a garter snake.
Big.
And that's a pretty thick snake, too, for a garter.
Probably a female and an older female that has managed to continue to grow. They continue to grow throughout their life, but they slow down. The amount of growth that they put on as they get older slows down. So this snake has had a good long life. It's probably lived in an area where it's been lucky enough to avoid – lawnmowers and cars, et cetera, et cetera. But, yeah, any of these snakes, once you get to about, like, 34 inches, that's a pretty huge garter snake. So this is an exceptionally large garter snake. Though, sorry to say.
Not a record. Very cool. Thanks, David.
Yeah.
More comments and pictures we're getting from you. Amy says, I'm a licensed wildlife rehabilitator. While I normally don't take reptiles or amphibians, I did get an injured toad turned into me last week. He has since been released. And Edward sent us a picture of an eastern red-spotted newt on Mount Abraham from Sunday, saying, at first we thought it was a plastic toy lizard until it took off. We're talking herps with Jim Andrews today. Jackson is calling in from Orange. Hi, Jackson. What are you thinking
Hello.
About today?
Okay. This is about a year ago. It was like 2 in the morning, and it was raining out. And I live in a horse barn, so it's level, you know. And this big, giant black lizard came walking in. And it, you know, it was over a foot long, and that's not just the tail. So with the tail added, it had to be 18 inches. Real thick black lizard. And I helped shepherd it out, back out of the building. Again, and I'm just curious what that was. A friend up the street saw one in the same month, too. It was a real rainy month. And one other thing after that, let me ask the second question. I came upon a female turtle digging a hole for eggs, and I shoot her off. And then I came back in a long traverse to come back, and she came back to the hole and dug this deep hole. And then she buried it so well, you couldn't even tell where the hole was. She, like, landscaped it. I was wondering how long it takes for those eggs to hatch.
All right, so two different questions. One of them is about turtle eggs, but the other is about this very large black lizard.
Well, I often hear people use the term lizard when they are also or may be referring to a huge salamander.
Because we only have one kind of lizard in Vermont?
We have one lizard, five-line skink, that doesn't get anywhere near that big or that heavy.
And is only really in one place,
right? And wouldn't be in Orange. Yeah, it would only be in western Rutland County. Now, there are other lizards that show up. And when I say lizard in this case, then we're talking about something that has scales like a snake, actually has claws. In most cases, they would be laying eggs, that sort of thing. But so there's two options here. One is that it's actually a salamander, which would be smooth skin and somewhat slimy and big and chunky and heavy.
And could be that big? Could be more than a foot long? Not including the tail? Okay.
No. That would be a little big. But they are impressively big. And the biggest and the one that I would expect in Orange and the one that he and his friend may have seen would be the spotted salamander, actually with yellow spots. Now, if we're going bigger than that, if we actually are going 18 and we're talking lizard in terms of, you know, dry, scaly skin, then the only thing it could be is a released critter that came from elsewhere, either purposefully released or accidentally came up on an RV or came up on a boat, on a trailer, or came in with somebody is bringing in rocks for foundations or whatever, and a lot of neat stuff, neat, but we hope it doesn't actually survive in the wild here, does come in that way. I mean, right now, just recently, I've had lizard reports from Grand Isle, which I suspect probably came in on something. But my guess is you ought to look at the pictures of the spotted salamanders, and beyond that, if it really is a lizard, dry, scaly skin, then it would have to be something imported. Love to see a picture. If you get a picture at some point and send me a picture, then we'll know for sure. We can figure out what it is.
So you're not of the perspective that it was a particularly vivid nightmare?
Not unless he's been licking toads.
Which, yeah, that could cause a problem. My dog licks the toads, and yeah, he does not enjoy it once he's licked.
He also had that question about turtles.
Yes, turtle
and,
nests.
You know, turtles do have to come on land to lay their eggs, and usually it's just once they have prospected and found the spot where they want to lay their eggs, they dig a flask-shaped hole, which is narrow at the top but wider at the bottom, and they do a really good job of first filling it in and covering it over, because predation is a big problem with eggs. And then they may even dump water from stored in their bladder, and they dump that on there, really clean it up so that any of the loose dirt around doesn't show up. And so it is really hard to see, unless a predator gets in there and digs up a nest, it's really hard to see where they've laid those eggs. And
do they want to? You said they have to pick a good spot. So what's a good spot?
Well, they're eggs, so they need to be incubated, and so they need exposure. They need sun, and so they can't lay those eggs in the woods. That's why they're in people's yards and gardens. And
why not right on the water's edge?
If it were exposed, and there was not a root problem, and by roots I mean shrubs, that's roots would go down fairly deep, which could then kill the eggs. So your garden is ideal. Your mulch is ideal. Your compost is ideal. But the grass roots don't go down very deep. And so the grass on the edge of a road near a wetland, or the grass in your lawn, is not an issue. They can dig through that, and the roots don't go deep enough. Their legs reach deeper than the roots of the grass. And then – in terms of how long, with a snapping turtle, most of those snappers will come out of the ground in September, sometimes as late as November, and that depends on temperature. That depends on what our temperature's been and incubation. With our painted turtles, it's interesting that our painted turtles actually hatch in the fall but don't come out of the ground. They just sit in the nests. They're all lined up, looking up, all winter, and then they emerge the next spring. So the painted turtle you wouldn't see coming out of the ground, the little babies, until almost a year later.
That seems like a boring way to spend the winter.
Oh, awful boring, but pretty much you're chilled down. And, I suppose if we're looking for a human analogy, it's like you've been put out for an operation. Yeah, I mean, there's not much going on in your brain.
No. So, and is it true that depending on the temperature of the nest, that determines the sex of the turtle eggs?
Yeah, sexual temperature-dependent sex determination is a pretty interesting thing. Sure, there's a critical time period in their development where if the temperature is in a certain range, you're going to be male, and if it's in a different range, you're going to be female. And that's most of our turtles. There's a couple of turtles that it's genetically determined, but most of our turtles, like the snappers and the painted turtles, their sex is developed by the temperature.
And that's not determined. Going to be affected by climate change?
Could be. I mean, there's all sorts of things that our wildlife have co-evolved with: patterns, temperatures, rainfall, amount of snow in the winter. And when we mess with that, when we change the climate, there are thousands of ways that they could impact our wildlife, many ways that we just can't really conceive of in advance. So we really shouldn't be messing with the climate.
We got a note from Jeff who sent us a picture saying, here is me and a locally endangered eastern rat snake found on my driveway and captured for a study being conducted at Bristol's Watershed Center to see where these guys are overwintering. A little daunting at first, but they're surprisingly docile and, dare I say it, even sweet in their own slithery way. And he's holding maybe a 4-foot-long snake by the looks of it, black on the back and kind of lighter colored on the underside.
Nice and a nice eastern rat snake, and they get up to 6.5-7 feet, at least in this state, larger in other places. You know, the analogy I use for a lot of people have fears of snakes. And the analogy I use is go grab a chipmunk or go grab any mammal. Grab yourself a skunk or a raccoon or something like that, and you're going to get bit and maybe worse. Comparatively, if you were to grab a non-venomous, remember that word, don't go grab a rattlesnake. If you were to grab a non-venomous snake and you know how to handle them so that they can move, and you handle them gently and support their bodies, your chances of getting bit or having anything done to you that's unpleasant other than perhaps a little musk that they might release.
Or as my son says, it peed on me.
Yeah. They're just amazingly docile. Our non-venomous snakes, even our venomous snake is amazingly docile, but don't go pick it up again.
And we only have one venomous snake, and that's the rattlesnake?
Timber rattlesnake.
And that's, again, only in Western Rutland County as well.
Right.
So if you see something rattling and you're not there, it's probably a milk snake?
Well, right. If it's rattling, it's most likely to be a milk snake, which a lot of us grew up calling spotted adders, same critter. But there are other snakes that can rattle. Even a garter snake once in a while will rattle its tail. But Jeff lives in an area where there is an interesting study going on where Cindy Sprague started a study. She's working with the state. She's working with me to find out where the den of those snakes in the watershed area is. And then we can perhaps figure out whether that den is in any danger of development or disruption and perhaps figure out what sort of conservation action needs to be taken. So it's a great study that Cindy's undertaking in that area.
All right. So we're short on time now. Let's see if we can get another call in here, though, quickly before we go. And Peggy in with us from Morrisville. Hi, Peggy. You got a story for us?
Hi. Yeah, I'm working for the state doing mosquito trapping. And I have a place on the sandbar, and about a month ago, I pulled the car off to the side of the road and put my foot out of the door, which was into the vegetation, and the ground moved, literally moved. And when I did put my foot down, I saw it was a lot of little frogs.
Ah, cool.
And that whole area was just covered, and I'm a wildlife biologist, but I do furry animals, and that ground was just moving with all these little frogs that it kind of looked like little leopard frogs, but I wasn't sure because the grass was so deep I couldn't tell. But every time I put my foot down, the ground would erupt.
I think you've got it right. I think they were northern leopard frogs. Sandbar is ideal habitat for northern leopard frogs, and it would be right about this time of year when all those little frogs are just metamorphosing, and most of those frogs won't make it through to next year. Most of those frogs will be food for something, but a few of them will, and they'll maintain that population hopefully for the long term.
And what a neat thing to see, just to step down and suddenly it's all moving with these tiny frogs. It's always fun to have you with us, Jim. I could do every day with you on herpetology. Maybe we should do the Vermont Edition Herpetology Every Day show.
There you go. I'm up for it.
At any rate, Jim coordinates the Vermont Reptile and Amphibian Atlas, and he is looking for reports, so check it out. You'll find a link at vpr.net. Thanks as always, Jim.
You're welcome.